belonged to her grandmother. The hinge was coming apart. Sarah carefully opened the lid. Two wedding rings rested on the satin pillow. Her husband had been a cop, which was basically where the similarity between Jeffrey and Will ended. Or maybe not. They were both funny. They had the same strong moral character that Sarah had always been attracted to. They were both drawn to duty. They were drawn to Sarah. That was one thing about Jeffrey that was completely different from Will. He had made no equivocations about wanting Sarah. It was clear from the beginning that he was going to have her. He'd strayed once, but Jeffrey had dragged himself through broken glass to win her back. Not that Sarah expected the same kind of dramatic gestures from Will, but she needed a stronger sign of commitment than just showing up in her bed every night. Sarah had fallen in love with her husband because of his beautiful handwriting. She'd seen his notes written in the margin of a book. The script was soft and flowing. Unexpected for someone whose work required him to carry a gun and occasionally use his fists. Sarah had never seen Will's handwriting, except for his signature, which was little more than a scrawl. He left her post-it notes with smiley faces on them. A few times, he'd sent her a text with the same. Sarah knew Will read the occasional book, but mostly stuck with audio recordings. As with many things, his dyslexia wasn't something they talked about. Could she love this man? Could she see herself being part of his life, or at least the part of his life that he allowed her to see? Sarah wasn't sure. She closed the box and returned it to its proper place on the mantel. Maybe Will didn't want her. Maybe he was just having fun. He still kept his wedding ring in the front pocket of his pants. Sarah had been pleased when he'd shown up with his finger bare, but she wasn't stupid. Neither was Will, which was why it was puzzling that he kept the ring in an area where her hands usually ended up. Sarah hadn't realized she was falling in love with Jeffrey when she'd opened that book and seen his writing. It was only later when she looked back that she realized what was happening. There were memories of Will that gave her heart that familiar tug. Watching him wash dishes at her mother's kitchen sink. The way he listened so intently when she talked about her family. The look on his face the first time he'd really made love to her. Sarah leaned her head against the mantel. Given enough idleness and time, she could talk herself into either loving or hating the man. Which was why she wished he would just bite the bullet and call her. The phone rang. Sarah jumped. She felt her heart thumping as she walked toward the phone, which was equal parts stupid and foolish. She'd gone to medical school, for the love of God. She shouldn't be so easily swayed by coincidence. Hello?
How is my favorite student? Pete Hansen asked.
He was one of the top MEs in the state. Sarah had taken several courses from him when she was medical examiner for Grant County.
I hear you're playing hooky from school.
Mental health day, she admitted, trying to hide her disappointment that it wasn't Will on the other end of the line. Then, because Pete never just called her out of the blue, she asked, "Is something wrong?"
"I have some news, my dear. It's fairly private, so I'd prefer to deliver it in person."
Sarah glanced around the apartment, which was upside down. Pillows on the floor, rugs rolled up, dog toys scattered around. Enough fur to build a new greyhound. Are you at City Hall East?
As always.
I'm on my way. Sarah ended the call and tossed the receiver onto the couch. She checked her reflection in the mirror. Her hair was frizzed with sweat. Her skin was blotchy. She was wearing jeans that were torn at the knees and a Lady Rebels t-shirt that had looked great back when she was in high school. Will worked in the same building as Pete, but he was on the south side all day, so there was no chance of running into him. Sarah grabbed her keys and left the apartment. She took the steps down to the lobby and didn't stop until she saw her car. There was another note tucked under the windshield wiper. Angie Trent had changed things up. Along with the familiar, horror, the woman had kissed the white notebook paper with her heavily lipsticked mouth. Sarah folded the note in two as she got into her car. She rolled down the window and tossed the paper into the trash can by the automatic gate. Sarah supposed Angie parked on the street and walked under the gate to put these notes on her car. Up until a few years ago, Angie had been a cop. Apparently, she had been one of the best undercover agents that the Vice Squad had ever had. Like many former police officers, she didn't worry about petty crime such as trespassing and terroristic threats. A horn beeped behind her. Sarah hadn't noticed the gate go up. She waved her hand in apology, pulling out into the street. If thinking about Will was a futile endeavor, thinking about his wife was a lesson in self-hatred. There was a reason Angie had so easily passed for a high-class call girl. She was tall and curvy and had that secret pheromone that let every interested man, or woman if the stories were true, know that she was available, which was why Will was going to be wearing a condom until his final blood test came back. That was, if they lasted that long. City Hall East was less than a mile from Sarah's apartment. Housed in the old Sears department store building on Ponce de Leon Avenue, the space was as sprawling as it was dilapidated. The metal windows and cracked brickwork had been pristine at one time, but the city hadn't the money to maintain such a vast structure. It was one of the largest buildings by volume in the southeastern United States, which only partially explained why half the complex stood vacant. Will's office was on one of the upper floors that had been taken over by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. The fact that Sarah had never seen his office was one of the many things she tried to push from her mind as she navigated the large loop down to the underground parking lot. Despite the mild climate, the parking garage was not as cool as it should have been, considering it was below ground. The morgue was even more subterranean, but, like the garage, was mildly warmer than expected. There must have been something wrong with the air circulation, or maybe the building was so old that it was doing its best to force the inhabitants to let it go. Sarah took the cracked concrete stairs down to the basement. She could smell the familiar odors of the morgue, the caustic products that were used to clean the floors and the chemicals used to disinfect the bodies. Back in Grant County, Sarah had taken the part-time job of medical examiner to help buy out her retiring partner at the children's clinic. The work in the morgue was sometimes tedious, but generally a lot more fascinating than the tummy aches and sniffles she treated at the clinic. That Grady Hospital was only marginally more challenging was yet another thought she pushed from her mind. Pete Hansen's office was adjacent to the morgue. Sarah could see him through the open door. He was bent over his desk, which was piled high with papers. His filing system wasn't one Sarah would have chosen, but many times she'd seen Pete pluck exactly what he needed from a random pile. She knocked on the door as she walked into the office. Her hand stopped midair. He'd lost weight recently. Too much weight. "Sarah," he smiled at her, showing yellow teeth. Pete was an aging hippie who refused to give up his long braided hair, even though there was considerably less of it. He favored loud Hawaiian shirts and liked to listen to the Grateful Dead while he performed procedures. As medical examiners went, he was fairly typical, which was to say, the bottled specimen of an 18-year-old victim's heart that he kept on a shelf above his desk was only in aid of his favorite joke. She set it up for him. "How are you doing, Pete?" Instead of telling her that he had the heart of an 18-year-old, Pete frowned. "Thanks for coming by, Sarah." He indicated an empty chair. Pete had obviously prepared for her. The papers and charts that were normally piled on the chair had been placed on the floor. Sarah sat down. "What's wrong?" He turned back to his computer and tapped the spacebar on his keyboard. A digital radiograph was on the screen. The frontal chest X-ray showed a large white mass in the middle portion of the left lung. Sarah looked at the file name at the top. Peter Wayne Hansen. "SCLC," he told her. small cell lung cancer, the deadliest kind. Sarah felt like she'd been punched in the gut.
The new protocol
doesn't work for me. He clicked the file closed. It's already metastasized to my brain and liver.
Sarah delivered bad news to her patients on a daily basis. She seldom found herself on the other end.
Oh, Pete. I'm so sorry. Well, it's not the best way to go, but it beats slipping in the tub.
He sat back in his chair. She saw it clearly now, the gauntness in his cheeks, the sallow look in his eyes. He indicated the jar on the shelf.
So much for my 18-year-old heart.
Sarah laughed at the inappropriate humor. Pete was a great doctor, but his best trait was his generosity. He was the most patient and giving teacher Sarah had ever had. He was delighted when a student managed to pick up on a detail he'd missed, a rare trait among physicians. He said,
"At the very least, it's given me a wonderful excuse to take up smoking again."
He mimicked, puffing a cigarette.
"Unfiltered Camels. My second wife hated them. You've met Dina, right?"
"I only know her by reputation." Dr. Coolidge ran the forensics lab at GBI headquarters. "Do you have any plans?"
"You mean a bucket list?"
He shook his head.
"I've seen the world. At least the parts of it I want to see. I'd rather make myself as useful as I can with what little time I have left. Maybe plant some trees at my farm that my great-grandchildren will climb on. Spend time with my friends. I hope that includes you."
Sarah willed herself not to tear up. She looked down at the cracked tile floor. There was so much asbestos in the building, she wouldn't be surprised to learn that Pete's cancer was down to more than cigarettes. She glanced at the pile of papers by the chair. A manila envelope was on top of the pile. Faded red tape, sealing it closed. The evidence was old. Deep creases maintained the accordion fold of the envelope. The areas that weren't yellowed with age were smeared black. Pete followed her gaze.
"Old case."
Sarah noted the date, which was over 30 years ago.
"Very old case. We were lucky they found it in evidence, though I'm not sure if we'll need it after all."
He picked up the envelope and put it on his desk, the black dust transferred to his fingers.
"The city used to purge closed cases every 5 years. We did some crazy stuff back then."
Sarah could tell the case meant something to him. She knew the feeling. There were still victims she'd worked on back in Grant County that would haunt her memories until the day she died.
Pete asked, "How are things at Grady?"
"Oh, you know." Sarah didn't know what to say. She was called bitch so often that she turned her head whenever anyone yelled the word. "Swimming pools and movie stars."
"In nearly 50 years, I've not once had a patient talk back or file a complaint against me."
He raised an eyebrow.
"You know they'll need someone to take my place when I'm gone."
Sarah laughed, then saw that he wasn't joking.
"Just a thought," he told her. "But this brings me to a favor I need to ask."
"What can I do?"
"I've got a case that just came in. It's very important. It has to hold up."
"Does it have anything to do with that?" She indicated the dirty envelope on his desk.
"Yes," he admitted. "I can do all the heavy lifting, but I need to make sure that 6 months, a year from now, someone's around to testify."
"You've got dozens of people working under you."
"Just 4 at the moment," he corrected. "Unfortunately, none of them possess the length and breadth of your experience."
"I don't.
You're still credentialed. I checked with the state."
He leaned forward.
"I'm not a duplicitous man, Sarah. You know that about me. So you'll understand that I'm being brutally honest when I tell you that this is a dying man's last request. I need you to do this for me. I need you to go to court. I need you to speak directly to a jury and put this man back where he belongs."
Sarah was
momentarily at a loss. This was the last thing she'd been expecting. Her apartment looked as if it had been hit by a tornado. She still had Will to deal with. She was dressed more suitably for a pickup softball game than for work. Still, she knew that she didn't have a choice.
There's already a suspect?
Yes. He shuffled the papers around and found a yellow file folder. Sarah scanned the preliminary report. There wasn't much. A dead Jane Doe had been found outside a dumpster in a fairly upscale part of town. She'd been beaten to death. Her wallet was absent cash. The bruising around her wrists and ankles indicated that she'd been tied up, possibly kidnapped. Sarah looked up at Pete. She had an awful sinking feeling. The missing Georgia Tech student?
We don't have positive ID yet, but I'm afraid so.
Death penalty case. Pete nodded.
Is the body here?
They brought her in half an hour ago.
Pete looked up at the doorway.
Hello, Mandy.
Pete. Amanda Wagner's arm was in a sling. She looked worse for the wear, though she still kept up the formalities.
Dr. Linton?
Dr. Wagner, Sarah returned. She couldn't help but look over the woman's shoulder for Will.
Amanda asked Pete, Did Vanessa come by?
First thing this morning, he explained to Sarah.
The fourth, Mrs. Hansen.
Amanda said, Dr. Linton, I hope we can avail ourselves of your expertise.
Sarah felt a bit managed. She asked the obvious question. Is this Will's case?
No. Agent Trent is absolutely not assigned to this case, which doesn't explain why I've spent the last 3 hours of my day walking up and down every hallway in a 12-story office building, talking to people who have better things to do than watch us chase our tails.
She paused for a breath.
Pete, when did we get so old?
Speak for yourself.
I always told you I was going to die young.
She laughed, but there was a sad edge to the sound.
I can still remember the first time you came into my morgue. Please, let's not get maudlin. Try to go out with some dignity.
He grinned like a cat. There was a moment between them, and Sarah wondered if Amanda Wagner had fallen somewhere along the timeline of the many Mrs. Hansons. The moment passed quickly. Pete stood from his desk. He reached out, bracing himself against the chair. Sarah jumped up to help him, but he gently pushed her away.
Not to that point yet, my dear, he told Amanda. You can use my office. We'll go ahead and get started.
Pete indicated that Sarah should leave ahead of him. She pushed open the doors to the morgue, resisting the urge to hold them for Pete. He seemed more diminished in the large tiled room. The office had served as a buffer against his wasted appearance. In the bright lights of the autopsy theater, there was no hiding the obvious.
A bit cool in here, Pete mumbled, taking his white lab coat off the hook.
He went to the cabinet and handed Sarah one of his spares. His name was stitched over the pocket. Sarah could have wrapped the coat around her body twice, but then so could Pete.
Our victim,
he indicated a draped body in the center of the room. Blood had permeated the sheet, which was unusual. Circulation stopped when the heart stopped beating. Blood congealed. Sarah couldn't help but feel some guilty excitement. She relished a difficult case. Working at Grady, dealing with the same types of ailments and injuries over and over again, could become a bit mind-numbing.
Pete said, We've already photographed and x-rayed her, sent her clothes to the lab. Do you know we used to just cut them off and throw them in a bag? In rape cases, he laughed. My God, the science was flawed from the beginning. There was no taking the victim's word for it. If we didn't find semen in the suspected attacker's underwear, then we couldn't legally sign off on a charge of rape.
Sarah didn't know what to say. She couldn't imagine how awful things used to be. Thankfully, she didn't have to.
Pete looped his braid on top of his head and pulled on an Atlanta Braves baseball hat. He was in his element inside the morgue, visibly more animated.
I remember the first time I talked to an odontologist about bite marks.
I was certain we were looking at the future of crime solving. Hair fibers, carpet fibers. He chuckled. If I have one regret about my impending doom, it's that I won't live to see the day when we've got everyone's DNA on an iPad, and all we have to do is scan some blood or a piece of tissue and up pops a current location for our bad guy. It'll end crime as we know it.
Sarah didn't want to talk about Pete's impending doom. She busied herself with her hair, tightening the band, tucking it into a surgeon's cap so she wouldn't contaminate anything.
How long have you known Amanda?
Since dinosaurs walked among us, he joked.
Then, in a more serious tone, he said,
I met her when she started working with Evelyn. They were both a couple of pistols.
The description struck Sarah as odd, as if Amanda and Evelyn had run around Atlanta like two Calamity Janes.
What was she like?
She was interesting, Pete said, which was one of his highest compliments.
He looked at Sarah's reflection in the mirror over the sink as he washed his hands.
I know it wasn't great when you came up in medical school. What were there, a handful of women?
If that, Sarah answered. But this last class was over 60%. She didn't mention that the ones who weren't taking time off to have children were mostly funneling themselves into pediatrics or gynecology, the same as they had when Sarah was an intern.
How many women were on the force when Amanda joined?
He squinted as he thought about it.
Less than 200 out of over 1,000?
Pete stepped back so Sarah could wash her hands.
No one thought women should be on the job. It was considered man's work. There was all kinds of grumbling about how they couldn't protect themselves, didn't have the cojones to pull the trigger. The truth was that everyone was secretly terrified they'd be better. Can't blame them.
Pete winked at her.
The last time women were in charge, they outlawed alcohol.
Sarah smiled back at him.
I think we should be forgiven one mistake in almost 100 years.
Perhaps, he allowed. You know, you listen to my generation these days. We were all free-loving hippies, but the truth is, there were more Amanda Wagners than there were Timothy Learys, especially in this part of the country.
He gave her a twinkling smile.
Not to say it entirely passed us by. I lived in a glorious singles complex off the Chattahoochee, Riverbend. Ever hear of it?
Sarah shook her head. She was enjoying Pete's reminiscing. His cancer was obviously compelling him to put his life in perspective.
A lot of airline pilots lived there. Stewardesses, lawyers, and doctors and nurses. Oh, my.
His eyes lit up at the memory.
I had a nice side business selling penicillin to many of the fine Republican men and women currently running our state government.
Sarah used her elbow to turn off the faucet.
Sounds like crazy times.
She had come of age during the AIDS epidemic, when free love started exacting its price.
Crazy indeed. Pete handed her some paper towels. When was Brown versus the Board of Education?
The desegregation case? Sarah shrugged. Her high school history class was some time ago. 54, 55?
Pete said, It was around that time that the state required white teachers to sign a pledge disavowing integration. They would lose their jobs if they refused.
Sarah had never heard of the pledge, but she wasn't surprised.
Duke, Amanda's father, was away when the pledge was circulating.
Pete blew into a pair of powdered surgical gloves before putting them on.
Miriam, Amanda's mother, refused to sign the pledge. So her grandfather, a very powerful man, he was a higher-up with Southern Bell, sent her off to Milledgeville.
Sarah felt her lips part in surprise.
He committed his daughter to the state mental hospital?
The facility was basically a warehouse back then, mostly for vets and the criminally insane, and women who wouldn't listen to their fathers.
Pete shook his head.
It broke her. It broke many people.
Sarah tried to do the math.
Was Amanda born yet?
She was around 4 or 5, I guess. Duke was still in Korea, so his father-in-law was in charge. I gather no one told Duke what was really going on. The minute he was back in Georgia, he grabbed Amanda and signed his wife out of Milledgeville. Never talked to his father-in-law again.
Pete handed Sarah a pair of gloves.
Everything seemed fine, and then one day Miriam went out into the back garden and hanged herself from a tree.
That's awful. Sarah pulled on the surgical gloves. No wonder Amanda was so closed down. She was worse than Will.
Don't let it soften you toward her too much, Pete warned. She lied to you in my office. She wanted you here for a reason.
Instead of asking what reason, Sarah followed his gaze to the door. Will was there. He stared at Sarah in utter shock. She had never seen him look so awful. His eyes were bloodshot. He was rumpled and unshaven. His body swayed from exhaustion. His pain was so obvious that Sarah could almost feel her heart breaking. Her instinct was to go to him, but Faith was there, then Amanda, then Leo Donnelly, and Sarah knew that a public display would only make things worse. She could read it in his face. He looked absolutely stricken to find her there. Sarah glared at Pete, making sure he knew that she was furious. Amanda may have lied about this being Will's case, but Pete was the only one who had lured Sarah to the morgue. She snapped off the gloves as she walked toward Will. He obviously didn't want Sarah to see him like this. She planned to take him into Pete's office to explain what had happened and apologize profusely. But Will's expression stopped her. Close up, he looked even worse. Sarah had to force herself not to put her hands to his face, rest his head on her shoulder. Exhaustion radiated from his body. There was so much pain in his eyes that her heart broke all over again. She kept her voice low. Tell me what you need me to do. I can leave, I can stay, whatever is best for you. His breathing was shallow. He gave her such a look of desperation that Sarah had to fight to keep herself from crying. Tell me what to do, she begged. What you need me to do. His gaze settled on the gurney. The victim on the table, he mumbled,
Stay,
as he walked into the room. Sarah let out a stuttered breath before she turned around. Faith couldn't look at her, but Amanda held her gaze. Sarah had never understood Will's mercurial relationship with his boss. But at that moment, she ceased caring. There was not another person on the planet right now whom Sarah despised more than Amanda Wagner. She was obviously playing some kind of game with Will, just as it was obvious that Will was losing.
Let's begin, Pete suggested.
Sarah stood to Pete's side, opposite Will and Faith, her arms crossed. She tried to calm her anger. Will had told her to stay. Sarah could not guess the reason why, but she didn't need to add more tension to the room. A woman had been murdered. That should be the focus.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Pete used his foot to tap on the dictaphone to record the procedure.
He called out the usual information. Time of day, persons present, and the victim's tentative identity of Ashley Renee Snyder.
ID has yet to be confirmed by family, though, of course, we'll follow with dental records, which have already been digitized and sent to the Panthersville Road Lab,
he asked Leo Donnelly.
Is the father en route? Squad car's picking him up from the airport. Should be any minute now.
Very good, detective.
Pete gave him a stern look.
I trust you're going to keep any wry comments or off-color jokes to yourself.
Leo held up his hands.
I'm just here for the ID so I can turn over the case.
Thank you. Without preamble, Pete grabbed the top of the sheet and pulled back the drape. Faith gasped. Her hand went to her mouth. Just as quickly, she forced her arm back down to her side. Her throat worked. She didn't blink. Faith had never had the stomach for these things. But she seemed determined to hold her own. Unusually, Sarah shared her discomfort. After all these years, she'd thought herself anesthetized to the horrors of violence. But there was something gut-wrenching about the state of the woman's body. She hadn't just been killed. She'd been mutilated. Bruises blackened her torso. Tiny red edemas cracked the skin. One of her ribs had punctured through the flesh. Her intestines hung between her legs. But that wasn't the worst of it. Sarah had never been one to believe in the concept of evil. She always thought the word was an excuse, a way to explain away mental illness or depravity. A safe word to hide behind, rather than face the truth that human beings were capable of despicable acts. That not much kept us from acting on our baser urges. Yet evil was the only word that came to mind when Sarah looked down at the victim. It wasn't the bruises, the punctures, even the bite marks that were shocking. It was the methodical slices along the insides of the woman's arms and legs. It was the crisscross pattern that traced up her hips and torso in an almost ruler-straight line. Her attacker had ripped the flesh the same way you would rip out a seam in a dress. And then there was her face. Sarah could not begin to understand what had been done to her face. Pete said, "The x-rays show the hyoid bone was broken." Sarah recognized the familiar bruising around the woman's neck. "Was she thrown off a building after she was strangled?" Pete said, "No, she was found outside a one-story building. The intestinal prolapse is likely from premortem external trauma, a blunt object or a fist. Do these striations look like finger marks to you, perhaps from a closed fist?"
"Yes."
Sarah pressed her lips together. The force of the blows must have been tremendous. The killer was obviously fit, probably a large man, and undoubtedly filled with rage. For all the world had changed, there were still men out there who absolutely despised women. "Dr. Hansen," Amanda asked, "for the benefit of the tape, what would you estimate is the time of death?" Pete smiled at the question.
"I would guess anywhere between 3 and 5 o'clock this morning,"
Faith volunteered. "The witness who saw the green van was out jogging around 4:30. He doesn't know the make or model." She still couldn't look at Sarah. "We've put out an APB, but it's probably a dead end."
4:30 this morning certainly works for me," Pete said. "As you all know, time of death is not an exact science."
Amanda huffed.
"Just like old times."
"Dr. Linton,"
Pete motioned for Sarah to join him.
"Why don't you take the left side and I'll take the right?"
Sarah pulled on a fresh pair of gloves. Will stepped back as she made her way around the table. He was being too quiet. He wouldn't meet her questioning gaze. Sarah still felt the need to do something for him. But there was an equally overwhelming pull to do right by the dead woman. Something told her that the latter would aid in the former. This was Will's case, no matter what lies Amanda had told. He obviously felt some emotional attachment. Sarah had never seen anyone look so bereft. And she understood why Pete wanted to make sure someone he trusted was able to testify. Every inch of the victim's body screamed for justice. Whoever had attacked and murdered Ashley Snyder had not just wanted to hurt her. He'd wanted to destroy her. Sarah felt a subtle shift in her brain as she prepared herself for the procedure. Juries had watched enough CSI to understand the basic tenets of autopsy, but it was the medical examiner's job to guide them through the science behind each finding. The chain of custody was sacrosanct. All the slide numbers, tissue samples, and trace evidence would be cataloged into the computer. The lot would be sealed with tamper-proof tape that could be opened only inside the GBI lab. Trace evidence and tissue would be profiled for DNA. The DNA would hopefully be matched to a suspect, and the suspect would be arrested based on incontrovertible evidence. Pete asked Sarah, "Shall we begin?" There were two Mayo trays prepared with identical instruments. Wooden probes, tweezers, flexible rulers, vials, and slides. Pete's had a magnifying glass, which he held to his eye as he leaned over the body. Instead of starting at the top of the head, he studied the victim's hand. As with the legs and torso, the flesh along the inside of her arm, from her wrist to her armpit, was ripped open in a straight line. It continued in a U to her upper torso, then followed down to her hips.
"You haven't washed her?" Sarah asked. The skin looked scrubbed. There was a faint odor of soap.
"No," Pete answered. "She looks clean," Sarah noted for the tape. "The pubic hair is shaved, no stubble on the legs." She used her thumb to press the skin around the eyes. Eyebrows tweezed into an arch, fake eyelashes. Sarah concentrated on the scalp. The roots were dark, the remaining strands a choppy yellow and white. "She has blonde hair extensions. They're attached close to the scalp, so they must be new." Sarah used the fine-tooth comb as best she could, working around the weave to remove any particles from the hair. The white paper under the girl's head showed dandruff and pieces of asphalt. Sarah set the specimens aside for processing. Next, she examined the hairline, checking for needle punctures and other marks that didn't belong. She used an otoscope to examine the nostrils. "There's some nasal corrosion. The membrane is torn, but not perforated." "Meth," Pete guessed, which was probable given the victim's age. He raised his voice. Either the dictaphone was old or he wasn't used to using it. "The fingernails are professionally manicured. The nails are painted a bright red," he suggested to Sarah. "Dr. Linton, perhaps you can check your side." Sarah picked up the woman's hand. The body was in the early throes of rigor mortis. "Same on this hand. Manicured, same polish." She didn't know why Pete was drawing such close attention to the fingernails. You couldn't throw a rock in Atlanta without hitting a nail salon. He said, "The pedicure color is different." Sarah looked at the girl's toes. The nails were painted black. Pete asked, "Is it normal for the toes to be different from the nails?" Sarah shrugged, as did Faith and Amanda. "Well," Pete said, but the opening refrain from Brick House cut him off. "Sorry," Leo Donnelly took his phone out of his pocket. He read the caller ID. "It's the patrolman I sent to the airport. Danny Snyder's probably outside." He answered the phone as he walked out the door. "Donnelly!" The room was quiet except for the hum of the motor on top of the walk-in refrigerator. Sarah tried to get Will's attention, but he just stared at the floor.
"Jesus Christ."
Faith wasn't cursing Donnelly. She was looking at the victim's face.
"What the hell did he do to her?"
There was a click as Pete's foot tapped off the dictaphone. He spoke to Sarah as if she'd been the one to ask the question. Her eyes and mouth were sewn shut. Pete had to use both hands to hold open one of the torn eyelids. They were shredded in thick strips like the plastic curtain inside a butcher's freezer. "You can see where the thread ripped through the skin," Sarah asked.
"How do you know this?"
Pete didn't answer the question.
"These lines along her torso, inside her arms and legs, a thicker thread was used to keep her from moving. I imagine an upholstery needle was used, probably a waxed thread or maybe a silk blend yarn. We'll probably find plenty of fibers to analyze."
Pete handed Sarah the magnifying glass. She studied the lacerations. As with the victim's eyes and mouth, the skin was ripped apart, flesh hanging down in even intervals. She could see the red dots where the thread had gone in. Not once, not a few times. The circles were like the holes in Sarah's earlobes where she'd gotten her ears pierced when she was a child. Amanda said,
"She must have ripped herself away from the mattress or whatever she was sewn to when he started beating her."
Pete expounded on the hypothesis.
"It would be an uncontrollable response. He punches her in the stomach, she curls up into a ball, mouth opens, eyes open, and then he punches her again and again."
Sarah shook her head. He was jumping to some pretty quick conclusions. "What am I missing?" Pete tucked his hands into the empty pockets of his lab coat, silently watching Sarah with the same careful intensity he used when he was teaching a new procedure. Amanda supplied,
"This isn't our killer's first victim."
Sarah still didn't understand. She asked Pete,
"How do you know?"
Will cleared his throat. Sarah had almost forgotten he was in the room.
He said, because the same thing was done to my mother.
17. June 15, 1975. Lucy Bennett. Father's Day. It was all over the radio. Richway was having a special sale. Davis Brothers was offering an all-you-can-eat buffet. The disc jockeys were talking about their favorite gifts from years past. Shirts, ties, golf clubs. Lucy's dad was easy to buy for. They always got him a bottle of scotch. Then 2 weeks would pass, and if there was anything left in the bottle, they'd all get a drink on the 4th of July while they watched the fireworks explode over Lake Spivey. Lucy's dad. She didn't want to think about him. About anyone she used to know. Patty Hearst was suddenly in the news again. Her trial was still a year off, but her defense had decided to leak details about the kidnapping. Lucy already knew what went down with that crazy chick. It happened back when Lucy was on the street. There was no one else to talk about it with back then. Except for Kitty, none of the other girls even knew Hearst's name. Or maybe Kitty was lying. She was good at lying. Pretending she knew things, when all it was, in the end, was an excuse to lure you in so she could stab you in the back like a sneaky little bitch. After Hearst, there was a reporter with the Atlanta Constitution who'd been kidnapped. They demanded $1 million for his release. They claimed to be from the SLA, too. What they were was idiots. They got snatched up by the cops. They didn't spend a dime of that money. $1 million. What would Lucy do with that kind of dough? The only bank in town who'd had the ransom cash on hand was CNS. Mills Lane was the bank president. His picture was in the paper a lot. He was the same guy who helped the mayor build the stadium. Not the black mayor, but the one who ran against Lester Maddox. Lucy felt the gurgle of laughter in her throat. The Pickrick. Maddox's restaurant on West Peachtree, he kept axes on the wall. Rumor was he'd smash one through the head of any nigger who dared walk through the front door. Lucy tried to imagine Juice going through the front door. An axe in his head. Brains spattered everywhere. Washington Rawson, the slum they'd torn down to build the Atlanta Stadium, Lucy's dad told her the story. They were there for a baseball game. The Braves. Chief Nakahoma, with his crazy big face running around with an axe he could have stolen from Lester Maddox. Lucy's dad said the stadium was supposed to revitalize the area. There were almost 1.5 million residents in the city limits, most of them living on government vouchers. If Atlanta couldn't strong-arm the Negras out of the city, then they'd just pave over them. The SLA paved over Patty Hearst. They were a cult. They brainwashed her. Or so said a doctor on the radio. The shrink was a woman, so Lucy took her opinion with a grain of salt, but she claimed that it only took 2 weeks for a person to become brainwashed. 2 weeks. Lucy had lasted at least 2 months. Even after the H had worn off. Even after she had stopped longing for the high. Even after she had learned not to move. Not to breathe too deep or too long. Even after she had stopped caring that she had sores on her back and legs from laying for so long in her own piss and shit. She'd glowed with hate whenever he came into the room. She'd flinched when he touched her. She'd made sounds in her throat, used words that even without moving her mouth, she knew he could understand. Satan. Devil. I'll kill you dead. Motherfucker. And then suddenly, he'd stopped coming. It had to be only a few days. You couldn't live without water for more than 2-3 days tops. So maybe he'd been gone 3 days. Maybe when he'd come through the door, she'd been crying. Maybe when he brushed back her hair, she didn't flinch. Maybe when he washed her, she didn't tense up. And maybe when he finally got on top of her, finally did the things that Lucy had expected him to do from day one, she'd felt herself responding. And then maybe when he left again,
She sobbed for him, longed for him, begged for him, missed him. Just like she'd done with Bobby, her first love. Just like she'd done with Fred, the guy who cleaned planes at the airport. Then Chuck, who managed the apartment complex. Then countless others who had raped her, beat her, fucked her, left her on the side of the road for dead. Stockholm Syndrome. That's what the woman doctor on CBS Radio called it. Walter Cronkite introduced her as a noted authority. She worked with victims of cults and mind control experiments. She seemed to know what she was talking about, but maybe she was just making excuses. Because what she was saying didn't entirely track. At least, not to Lucy. Not to the girl who slept in her own excrement. Not to the girl who couldn't move her arms or legs. Not to the girl who couldn't open her mouth unless it was cut open for her. Couldn't blink without the razor-sharp edge of his pocket knife slicing through the tiny stitches of thread. The second Lucy saw an opening, the minute she saw even the sliver of a chance, she would escape. She would run to her freedom. She would crawl on her hands and knees back home. She would find her parents. She would find Henry. She would go to the cops. She would rip her body from this mattress and find a way to get home. Patty Hearst was a stupid bitch. She was in a closet. But no one held her down. She had a chance. She had ample opportunity. She'd stood with a rifle in that bank yelling SLA bullshit when she could have just run out the door and asked for help. If Lucy had a rifle, she'd use it to shoot the man in the head. She'd pound in his skull with the stock. She'd rape him with a long barrel. She'd laugh when the blood poured from his mouth and his eyeballs popped out. And then she'd find that woman doctor from the radio and tell her that she was dead wrong. Patty Hearst wasn't helpless. She could have gotten away. She could have bolted at any time. But then the doctor might point out that Lucy had something Patty Hearst did not. Lucy wasn't alone anymore. She didn't need Bobby, or Fred, or Juice, or her father, or even Henry ever again. She no longer marked time by the feel of warm sunlight rising or falling across her face, or the seasonal change in temperature. She marked her passage not in days, but in weeks, and months, and the cresting swell of her belly. It would happen any day now. Lucy was going to have a baby. 18. July 14th, 1975. Monday. Captain Bubba Keller was one of Duke's poker buddies, which meant that he likely had his white robe pressed at the dry cleaner where Dina Coolidge's mother had died. Keller's wife would be the one dropping off his laundry. He probably had no idea who cleaned it. Amanda had never given much thought to her father's Klan affiliation. The Klan still controlled the Atlanta Police Department when men like Duke Wagner and Bubba Keller joined. Membership was compulsory, the same as paying dues to the Fraternal Order of Police. Neither man had likely objected. They were both of German descent. They had both joined the Navy in hopes of being sent to the Pacific rather than having to fight in the European theater. They both wore their hair in tight military cuts. Their pants were always creased. Their ties were always straight. They took charge of things. They opened doors for ladies. They protected the innocent. They punished the guilty. They understood right and wrong. That is to say, they were right, and everyone else was wrong. Back in the late 60s, Police Chief Herbert Jenkins had drummed the Klan out of the force, but most of the men with whom Duke played poker still honored the former affiliation. As far as Amanda could tell, membership consisted solely of sitting around and grousing about how much things had changed for the worse. All they could talk about was the good old days, how much better things had been before the coloreds ruined everything. What they didn't acknowledge was that the things that made it bad for them made it better for everyone else. Over the last few days, Amanda had found herself thinking that injustice was never more tragic than when you found it knocking at your own door. She tried to keep this in perspective as she walked into the Atlanta jail. Captain Bubba Keller took pride in his post, though the Decatur Street building was despicable, worse than anything you'd find in Attica. Bats hung from the ceiling. The roof had gaping holes. The concrete floor was crumbling. During the winter, prisoners were allowed to sleep in the hallways rather than risk freezing to death inside their cells. Last year, a man had been rushed to Grady after being attacked by a rat. The creature chewed off most of his nose before the guards managed to beat it off with a broom. The most surprising part of that story was not that there was a broom at the jail, but that a guard had noticed something was amiss. Security was lax. Most of the men were already inebriated when they showed up for work. Escapes were routine, a problem compounded by the fact that the secretarial pool was adjacent to the cells. Amanda had heard horror stories from some of the typists about rapists and murderers running past their desks on their way out the front doors. "Ma'am," a patrolman said, tipping his hat to Amanda as she walked up the stairs. He took a deep breath of fresh air as he headed toward the street. Amanda imagined she'd do the same thing when she left this nasty place. The smell was almost as bad as the projects. She smiled at Larry Pierce, who ran the property room from behind a cage door. He gave her a wink as he sipped from his flask. Amanda waited until she was on the stairs to look at her watch. It wasn't yet 10 in the morning. Half the jail was probably lit. The whir of Selectrix got louder as Amanda headed toward the typing pool. This had been her dream job, but now she couldn't imagine sitting behind a desk all day. Nor could she imagine working for Bubba Keller. He was lecherous and bombastic, two things he didn't bother to hide from Amanda, despite being close friends with Duke. She often wondered what would happen if she told her father that Keller had grabbed her breast on more than one occasion, or about the time he'd pushed her up against the wall and whispered filthy things in her ear. Amanda wanted to think that Duke would be angry, that he would end the friendship, that he would pop Keller in the nose. The possibility that he might not do any of these things was likely what kept her from telling him. True to form, she could hear Keller's raised voice over the hum of typewriters. His office faced the typing pool, which was large and open. 60 women sat behind rows of desks, diligently typing, pretending that they couldn't hear what was going on a few yards away. Holly Scott, Keller's secretary, stood in his open doorway. She was wise not to go in. Keller's face was bright red. He waved his arms in the air, then swooped down his hand and pushed all the papers onto the floor.
"You goddamn do that!" he yelled.
Holly mumbled something back, and he picked up his telephone and threw it against the wall. The plaster cracked, sending down a rain of white powder.
"Clean up this mess!"
Keller ordered, grabbing his hat and stomping out of his office. He stopped when he saw Amanda.
"What the hell are you doing here?"
The lie came without much thought.
"Butch Bonnie asked me to check." "I don't care," he interrupted. "Just don't be here when I get back."
Amanda watched him push his way toward the exit. He was the very definition of a bull in a china shop. Desks were shoved out of the way. Stacks of paper were knocked onto the floor. There were 60 women seated at 60 desks, working on 60 typewriters and trying their darndest not to be singled out. And then finally, there was an audible collective sigh of relief as Keller left the room. The typewriters were momentarily silenced. Someone screamed back in the cells.
Holly said, "Good night, Irene."
Titters of laughter went around the room. The typewriters whirred back into motion. Holly waved Amanda back into Keller's office.
"Goodness," Amanda said. "What was that about?"
Holly bent over, picking up a broken bottle of old granddad bourbon.
"I just lost it."
Amanda knelt down to help her pick up the scattered papers.
"Lost it how?"
We are all trying to get Reggie's new handbook typed for the printer.
Holly tossed the broken glass into the trash can.
We are on deadline. The brass is breathing down our necks, breathing down Keller's.
And?
And so Keller thinks that's the perfect time to call me into his office and tell me to show him my tits.
Amanda sighed. She was familiar with the request. It was usually followed by a disturbing laugh and a groping hand.
And?
And I told him I was going to file a complaint against him.
Amanda picked up the telephone. The plastic was cracked, but it still had a dial tone.
Would you really do it?
Probably not, Holly admitted. My husband told me if he does it again to just get my purse and leave.
Why don't you?
Because that asshole's one more tantrum away from a heart attack. I'm going to outlive him if it kills me.
She scooped up the last of the papers. There was a smile on her face.
What are you doing here anyway?
I need to talk to an inmate.
White or black?
Black.
Good. There's an awful case of lice being passed around.
Everyone knew the coloreds didn't get lice.
Keller's going to have to set off a can of DDT back there. It's the third time this year. The smell is just awful.
Holly took a pen off the desk and held it over a sheet of paper.
Who's the girl?
Amanda felt a thickness in her throat.
Male.
Holly dropped the pen.
You want to go back there to talk to a black man?
Dwayne Matheson.
My God, Mandy, are you crazy? He killed a white woman. He already confessed.
I just need a few minutes.
No.
She vehemently shook her head.
Keller would have my scalp, and rightfully so. I've never heard anything so crazy. Why on earth would you want to talk to him?
Not for the first time, Amanda realized that she would be better served to plan out her explanations in advance.
It's for one of my cases.
What case?
Holly sat down at the desk to organize the papers. There were two more bottles of bourbon on the blotter, one of them almost empty. The cut crystal glass between them showed a permanent ring from Keller's constantly replenishing his drink throughout the day. Crude renderings of a penis and a pair of breasts were carved into the soft wood of the desk. Holly looked up at her.
What is it?
Amanda pulled around another chair, just as Trey Callahan had this morning at the Union Mission. She sat across from Holly. Their knees were almost touching.
There are some missing girls.
Holly stopped collating.
You think the pimp killed them too?
Amanda didn't outright lie.
Maybe.
You should tell Butch and Rick it's their case, and you know they're going to hear about this.
She put one hand on her heart and held up the other, as if swearing allegiance.
They won't hear about it from me or my girls, but you know it'll get around.
I know.
There was nothing more prevalent in any police force than gossip.
But I want to do it.
Mandy?
Holly shook her head as if she couldn't understand what had happened to her friend.
Why are you inviting trouble?
Amanda stared at her. Holly Scott had a dancer's lean body. She ironed her long red hair straight. Her makeup was expertly applied. Her skin was perfect. Even in this miserable heat, she could be photographed for a magazine ad. That she took near-perfect dictation and could type 110 words a minute were probably factors Keller had not even considered when he'd hired her. Amanda reached back and closed the door. The typewriters were just as loud, but it engendered a feeling of confidentiality. She told Holly, "Rick Landry threatened me." She didn't feel right bringing Evelyn's name into this, but Amanda was telling the truth when she said, "He called me a slit in front of my boss. He cursed at me. He told me I should stay the F away from his case." Holly's lips pressed together in a straight line.
"Aren't you going to listen to him?"
"No,"
Amanda said.
"I'm not. I'm tired of listening to them. I'm tired of being scared of them and doing all their bidding when I know better than they do."
The words were said quietly, but there was an air of revolution about them. Holly nervously glanced over Amanda's shoulder. She was afraid of being heard. She was afraid of being any part of this.
Still, she asked, "Have you ever been into men's holding?"
"No."
"It's awful down there. Worse than the women's side."
"I assumed it would be."
"Rats, feces, blood."
"Don't oversell it."
"Keller will be furious."
Amanda forced up her shoulders in a shrug.
"Maybe this will give him that heart attack you've been waiting for."
Holly stared at her for a good long while. Her blue eyes glistened with tears that did not fall.
She was visibly afraid.
Amanda knew she had a kid and a husband who worked two jobs so they could live in the suburbs. Holly went to school at night. She helped out at church on Sundays. She volunteered at the library. And she came here 5 days a week and put up with Keller's advances and innuendo because the city was the only employer around that followed the federal law mandating women be paid the same salary as men. And yet, Holly held Amanda's gaze as she reached over for the phone on Keller's desk. Her finger found the dial. There was a slight tremor in her hand. She didn't have to look down as she dragged the rotary back and forth. Holly put through calls for Keller all day long. She was silent as she waited for the line to engage.
"Martha," she said, "this is Holly up in Keller's office. I need you to have a prisoner transferred to holding for me."
Amanda watched her carefully as Holly relayed Dwayne Matheson's information. She had to shuffle through the papers from Keller's desk to get his arrest record, which had his booking number. Her hands steadied as they performed the familiar task. Her nails were short and clear-coated, like Amanda's. Her skin was almost as white as Jane Delray's, though, of course, absent any track marks. Amanda could see the thin blue lines of the veins in the back of the other woman's hand. She looked down at her own hands, which were clasped in her lap. Her nails were neatly trimmed, though she hadn't bothered with polish the night before. The skin along the side of her palm was scratched. Amanda didn't remember injuring herself. Maybe she'd scraped off the skin while she was cleaning her father's house. There was a piece of metal sticking out of the refrigerator that always caught her hand when she cleaned it out. Holly put down the phone.
"He's being transferred. It'll be about 10 minutes.
She paused.
"I can call them back, you know. You don't have to go through with this."
Amanda had other things on her mind.
"Can I use the phone while I wait?"
"Sure."
Holly groaned as she hefted the phone around.
"I'll be outside. I'll let you know when they're ready."
Amanda found her address book in her purse. She should be scared about coming face to face with Juice again, but looking at her scratched hand had put a question in her mind. She kept an index card in the back of her address book that listed the numbers she used on a daily basis. Butch was constantly leaving out details in his notes. Amanda had to call the morgue at least once a week. She usually talked to the woman who handled the filing, but today she asked for Pete Hansen. The phone was picked up on the third ring.
"Coolidge!"
Amanda considered hanging up, but then she had a flash of paranoia, as if Dina Coolidge could somehow see her. The jail was only a few buildings down from the morgue. Amanda glanced around nervously. Dina said,
"Hello?"
"It's Amanda Wagner."
The woman let some time pass.
"Uh-huh."
Amanda looked out into the typing pool. All the women were hard at work, back straight, heads slightly tilted, as they typed the pages of a handbook that would more than likely be used as toilet paper by half the force and target practice by the other.
"I had a question for Dr. Hansen," Amanda said.
"If he's around?"
"He's in court all day, testifying on a case."
Dina seemed to lose some of her wariness.
"May I help you with something?"
Amanda closed her eyes. This would be so much easier with Pete.
"I had a question about the piece of skin found under the victim's fingernail."
Amanda looked down at the scratch on her palm.
"I was wondering..."
She couldn't do this.
Maybe she would wait for Pete.
He would probably be back in the office tomorrow. Jane Delray wouldn't be any more dead by then.
Dina said, "Come on, girl, don't waste my time. Spit it out."
"Pete found something under the girl's fingernail on Saturday.
Right, skin tissue. She must have scratched her assailant.
Did you analyze it yet?
Not yet. Why?
Amanda shook her head, wishing she could just melt into the chair. It was probably best to just blurt it out. If the attacker was Negro, wouldn't the skin under the girl's fingernail be black?
Hmm.
Dina was quiet for a few seconds.
Well, you know, Pete's got this special light. You shine it on the skin sample, and it glows this kind of orange if it's from a